I'm really delighted to be here today with Rick Walker. How do you do, Rick?
Very well, Karen. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm admiring that painting behind you. I have this concept in my mind of what makes for great visual work, and that just it's just a tiny bit off balance, but for the main part, it's because there needs to be a papa mama baby. There needs to be a dominance of one thing, and that one is almost half half dark and light, but each panel has got a pretty good balance to it. So overall, I really like it. And is that like a gold that works through there, kind of?
Yes, it has some gold inflection there, and they have gold frames around there to
Yeah.
work with that. It'd be nice to have something where I could actually do a full sort of rule of thirds across.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting painting. Anyway, I like it. I like your space. I like your chair, the whole nine yards.
Thank you.
So, welcome to the Meaning Code. And you're here today because I saw a video that you made a couple of months ago about free will. And I know you've been participating a little bit with some people that are tangent to my channel. And you've had some conversations, I think, with Paul Vanderclay and couple of other people, maybe.
Yes.
How did that go for you?
Well, Paul's exciting. Paul is just a really smart guy. He can go any direction. I was teasing him at the very beginning about this conversation he did with Vervaeke. He did the edit version and the non-rated version. And I teased him. I thought that was a very impressive prose of his full vulgarity and the rawness of the nudity and everything you expect in a Vervaeke video. And he enjoyed that remark. I'm just trying to press him a little bit and see if you can get a pastor to open up, and he opens up. It's great.
Yeah, no, Paul is real. He is the essence of real. So the question that you talked about in your video was the question of free will. Do we have free will? Why is free will necessary? And then also, what does it mean to surrender your will? And the particular question that I had about that is that how does one put together, how does one synthesize the surrender of the will with maintaining our unique identities as individuals or as human beings? Or is it important to have an individual identity? But before we get to that, I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about how you got to be you and why on earth did you start a YouTube channel?
Yeah, great question, Karen. So I'm a guy that sits in an office all day. I'm an entrepreneur, and probably 3 years ago, maybe 3.5 years ago, we had moved into this place, and I had my executive assistant sitting at one desk, and the marketing director was sitting next to her. And the executive assistant would mention the sorts of people I would go out to have lunch with, or dinner with, or vacation with, and they ended up being like fairly well-known people. It's just the way that life works out sometimes. And the marketing director got to say, well, video is a really big thing right now. We need to have some video content. Maybe we can get Rick together and get some of his friends on video having conversations. And so that's the way the first of the conversations happened, probably 3 years ago. In fact, I was looking, I got an alert on my timeline on Facebook yesterday, which I'm rarely on, that 3 years ago I interviewed U.S. Senator Mike Lee, which I think was my third or fourth interview on that series of, I think it had 10 or 12 interviews in that first season. And so we had a set designed, and we had just rolled out, one person after another. And we've interviewed a lot of fun people that are, sitting members of Congress. We had a billionaire. We had a Grammy award-winning country music artist. We've had, various other people, Secret Service protectees we've had here. All sorts of people for conversations, and it's just been a lot of fun. The problem was at the end, by the very last one, you can go back and look at it. The very end, the series is called Conversations at the Mansion. You go back and look at the last one, you look at the opening scene with the very last person of the year walking out, and this was the Secret Service protectee. We had six cameras moving with a guy walking out from the back room into a live audience that had been there for a couple hours. So think about that. You've got valet, you've got an outer perimeter security, you got Secret Service, you got personal security, And then you've got liquor, you've got food, you've got all this stuff. And so at the end of the first season, Karen, I was like, well, how are we doing budget-wise? So I wasn't tracking it at all. And she said, well, we spent $250,000 on 10 shows. And I said, wait, let's do a timeout right here. Let's regroup. And so I stopped for a few months. And since then, I've really just done these sort of talking heads and if some of these Zoom interviews. And I haven't really taken it very seriously as I did 2 or 3 years ago. But it's just been a lot of fun getting to meet people like Paul and you
I'm
and a number
guessing
of other individuals.
you're having more fun.
Yes. Yeah, this is a little bit less stress. A little bit less stress, yes.
Yeah. But how did you get to be an entrepreneur? I mean, what was your trajectory towards that when you were growing up, for example?
Yeah. So when I grew up, we grew up fairly poor. We grew up in a two-bedroom house down in Corpus Christi, Texas, which is sort of halfway between where I live now in Houston and the Mexican border. And my dad was out of work a lot when we were growing up. So we had a very difficult time. And my mom had to work two jobs, sometimes three jobs, just to make the mortgage. And so we grew up in that atmosphere. And so as soon as I could get out and went to college, I became very entrepreneurial very, very quickly because I did not want to live like that later on. And so I started a number of businesses. Some of them I closed them down or I sold them to be able to roll the capital into what became a commercial real estate, a series of commercial real estate businesses that I have now. And that was been 26 years ago when I was in college. And so I just, I enjoy the entrepreneurialism of it. I also enjoy the creativity. I was a trumpet performance major in college. And so I really love music. I really love innovation. I was a jazz player quite a bit. And so I love improvisation. And so this was just a natural fit for me as I really got started. And I really like launching new initiatives, new efforts. And I really get bored after a couple of years. So that's sort of my nature, but that's also a little of my background as well.
It's really fascinating to me because my husband and I both grew up in very poor backgrounds. He's quite a bit more poor than mine. He grew up in Hong Kong, a family of six kids. He was the youngest, and they were so poor that they couldn't afford an apartment, but they managed to get a few pieces of tin and wood. And on top of a high rise of building in Hong Kong, his father nailed together. So they're kind of squatting on top of this building on the rooftop. Nailed together a little hut for the family to live in. So you can imagine the nail holes in the tin, the rain is coming through, the heat, the anytime there's a windstorm, it tears the thing apart, they have to rebuild it. That was his childhood. And he came up out of it the same way you did. He determined he was never going to be poor again. But I grew up in a poor household. My dad was military, and when he retired, he was never able to find anything that really worked for him. And so he was out of work quite a lot. My mother started a very small business in our home to try to make ends meet. But I just sort of, it never occurred to me to try to go out and like make a lot of money or something. I just sort of fell into one thing after another. I've done a lot of interesting things in my life, but I just fell into them. It wasn't ever this great drive to be an entrepreneur. But so it's fascinating to me. I mean, that's a fascinating aspect of free will right there, how people can go through the same kind of a trajectory and come out the other end with a completely different experience.
Yes. Yeah. And I think a lot of folks that seek a entrepreneurial type of pursuit are doing so not because of the money, but because of the optionality that the money brings. And the optionality is sort of a layer over the free will. It enables the free will to fully express itself in a multitude of fashions in a variety of domains. And so obviously, the more funds that you have, the more optionality you can invoke in various domains. And so it's a nice place to be able to play. And that's why you have people like Bezos that are playing in space and Musk in space. And they're doing all these sorts of crazy things just because their curiosity drives them, but they have that optionality there that allows them to pursue those pursuits. And I don't have that kind of money, but it's nice not to have to worry about certain things. And you get to waste money on a podcast if you have to, or if you're incompetent enough that you do that. But yeah, I think the idea of optionality and and money, I think those are very highly correlated with the free will and its execution.
Well, I mean, let's go back to this idea of free will. Do you think we have free will? I mean, you know, we're living in a universe right now where there are a lot of scientists who would say, oh, well, you don't, there is no such thing as free will. Everything is determined from the very first explosion of the universe, so that you and I are just having this conversation because our brain cells are firing in a certain way that was ordained. So how do you feel about that?
Yeah, you know, and I'm not very creative on this, Karen. I'm going to lean on Lewis on this, and I'm going to go back to the 1930s and early 1940s Nazi concentration camps. I'm going to go back to the Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago. I'm going to go to either the last October, the slaughter of 40 innocent babies in Israel. I'm going to go back to the depravity of evil and show that that is by necessity an act of free will that is against the core of goodness itself, right? You know, in my opinion, if you show evil, you can very closely, very soon get to an idea of free will. But then Lewis also goes the other direction that free will is the only thing that makes love worth having. It's the action behind the love itself. And that if you've ever experienced any drop of love itself, you've experienced an efficiency or an efficacy of free will in its display. And so I would lean on both those two arguments, and I think Lewis was absolutely right on that. Again, I'm a simpleton. I am not an educated person, but I like the way that he interposes the two, and he also weaves those together through a variety of stories.
Well, I mean, that makes sense to you and to me, but if you take someone who's a complete materialist like Sapolsky, who's the one who's got the big book out right now about no free will, he would probably just say that that evil and love they're not objective. They're not objective reality. They're not material reality, so they don't actually exist. It's just some sort of a social construct in our minds.
Yeah, and I think that's always the easy thing, right? We've been seeing the French intellectuals do this for 100 years. Well, they will make the I want to I see it as a derogatory type of claim on the intellect of other fellow man, that we just don't understand, that it's, you know, we have the deconstruction, we have not seen the deconstruction that only they can see. And it's just a reiteration of Gnosticism, in my opinion. It's a Gnosticism of the secular cult, that has devastated the world probably the last 300 years, in my opinion. And so I think that it gets to be tough when you find someone that has a true, rich, loving, relationship that is committed, for them to argue that person doesn't love you out of their own free will. I mean, it bastardizes love very, very soon, very, 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 very soon. And I think you've got to take a step back. I mean, if you move back from Lewis and you move back to really who he heard a lot of this from is Chesterton, right? And Chesterton has this great argument that the intellect is inferior to the imagination. And that whenever we let the intellect drive and we ignore what the imaginative tells us is true, that we find ourselves in a place that is naturally evil, because we let the lower tell the upper what it is. And so I in my opinion, I'm an imaginative person that controls the intellect. I don't ever want to see the intellect control my imagination, because it's the lesser of the two.
Well, that's, I mean, there's certainly an aspect in which I can see that. I've read some Chesterton, but you know, reading Chesterton is like drinking from a fire hose. Every sentence is a book. So it takes me a long time to get through any Chesterton. But I guess when I have a framework in my head of how things make sense to me, and part of it is you've probably read some McGilchrist, Ian McGilchrist's Master and His Emissary and The Matter with Things. And,
Very, very little, but yes.
oh, okay. Well, I spent quite a bit of time on it a few years back, and very compelling argument about how the two hemispheres of the brain operate together. And of course, the right hemisphere of the brain would be more in sync with this idea of the imaginal, and the left hemisphere of the brain would be more in sync with the idea of intellect. He thinks of the right hemisphere of the brain as being kind of the receptive, open aspect of the brain, drawing in what's out there to be known, and then handing it over to the left hemisphere. And then the left hemisphere can focus and build things and operate and manipulate. In his argument, he makes an argument that the problem has come through history when the left hemisphere sort of starts taking over and doesn't recognize, and he would say also the superiority of the right hemisphere, that the right hemisphere is the master, the left hemisphere is the emissary. So really, knowledge should come in through the right hemisphere, be worked through the intellect of the left hemisphere, and then come back to the right hemisphere to come back to the wholeness. Almost like you have the whole, and then you go to the parts, and then you have to come back to the whole. That's the way I
Yes.
picture it in my mind. But I don't think that that necessarily means that the left hemisphere is inferior to the right hemisphere, because it seems to me like it's a marriage. And in some sense, the right hemisphere is closer to what we might think of as the feminine aspect, and the left hemisphere is more similar to the masculine aspect. In my mind, this is not
Okay.
McGilvers now, this is me talking. And I say that because in my husband and my case, I am totally the right hemisphere, he is the left hemisphere. But marriage is such that when the two are united, you get something more than you have with either one by themselves. And I think that structure of marriage is kind of at the center of the universe. I mean, obviously, the universe is this great romance where God creates the universe, and the church becomes the bride of Christ. So it's like this great romance of preparing the bride for the consummation of the bridal supper, right? So in that case, if my theory is correct, that the right hemisphere is more like the feminine aspect and the left hemisphere the masculine aspect, there's no way that I could say that Christ is inferior to his bride, right? But it's the union of the two that makes something more, not better, but something more. And like in a marriage, each person gives 100%, but then you each get back 200%,
Correct.
right?
Yes. Yes. And you also have two equals, but they're different functions too, right? And it seems that, that would be an interpretation of Chesterton, perhaps, that the imagination is the kind of the tiebreaker in the relationship, right? There's still a role for the intellect, but there's also this imaginative presupposition that it can see furthest than what the mind can see. It can see out farther because it can sense where the beauty and where the purpose and the meaning is, and it's not looking for a mathematical equation. And this is one of the reasons why, I think 2 days ago I'm working on a book, and I started the editing about a month ago. And I think I was at 80,000 words, and he's got me developing certain things. I think I just hit 100,000 words yesterday on it, and I do some spacing as well, and so I'm approaching 600 pages on the thing, and I know I've got to get this thing cut. And one of the things that I've really gone down a rabbit hole on is this idea of seeing furthest, the thing, the part of you that has the longest vision, and the confluence of where love, beauty, and truth meet, obviously in the person of Christ, and where those go. And I'm convinced that it needs something more than the totality of the technical definition of wisdom, which is, a lot of folks will use. I think I hear Vivek talking about this idea of it's the confluence of all the knowledges and all the interpretations and across a variety of domains that are kind of come together, and it creates wisdom. And I sense that it's something more as a Christian, because I know that obviously Christ is the wisdom of God. Christ is the personified wisdom. It's not that that wisdom was the personification of Christ. It's the other way around. And so I've got to think that it's more the active and not just the technical computational mode of cogitation.
Yeah, so the interesting thing to me is we're all coming to the same, there's all these things and they're all coming to the same place, right?
Yes.
Because I was just looking at some notes. I have so many notes. I could write a 600-page book if I had your diligence and discipline, probably. But there is this argument that I was just reading a comment that one of my readers had made, and now of course I can't find it, but it was this idea that Peugeot and Peterson and these guys are bringing us to a recognition of something that maybe the church has not seen so clearly, because the church often, and when I say church, I mean all believers anywhere who are whatever kind of denomination you're in, if you're in a relationship with Christ, you're part of the church. So, the church has in the past tended to focus on those levels above. Let's look to, whatever the levels above us are that get us in touch with God. Peugeot and Peterson are bringing us to look at the embodied aspect of action. And the picture that I have, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I was just
That's
writing this
great.
down. I have this very big picture that I think fits right into what you're trying to say about wisdom, about how the world functions. And I think that that art and science and the path of life, just lived experience, all have pretty much the same structure, this structure of reality. And because I think they're all the same structure, I'll speak only about art, but you'll see it in life as well. You'll see it in science. And that is that you have an idea. The idea comes to you whole. You probably have this. An idea comes to you, oh, I could do this in a company. Bing, that idea is there. But it's not differentiated. It's just a unity in your mind. And then you have to find some way to express that unity. And because we're time-oriented creatures, for us, the only way it can get expressed is one step at a time, one stroke at a time. I'm going to paint a painting. This idea comes out one stroke at a time. Each stroke as it goes down is creating a new context for all the strokes that will follow. And so each stroke basically has a unique identity. And those strokes are also, if you could go back at the end of the painting and look at the entire painting and look at each stroke that's in the painting, there would be a history of the painting embedded in each stroke of the painting. In the same way that if you look at the history of the universe, every photon of light actually carries within it all of the history of the universe and a map of the whole cosmos as well. So if you think of this in terms of a person living your life, there is a part of you, the right hemisphere of your brain, that has access to this other that's out there, whether that other is any kind of the knowledges that Verbeke is talking about, or whether there's something more, something other that the right hemisphere has access to. That would be analogous to what Esther Meek is talking about when she talks about the covenant of knowing, that the knowledge that's out there is actually a gift being offered to us from God. So when we're seeking after something new, it's God offering us something. We can see that little glimmer out in the future that's drawing us forward. Your new company, your idea that's out there, it's going to draw you forward. That's an offering of love from God. So, as you begin to pursue that thing step by step in life, you face Jordan Peterson's combinatorial explosion of the infinity of possibilities. And the only way you can make your way through that path is with some sort of a frame that allows you to see the next step forward. That's where constraint comes in. So constraint is so important in constructing necessity, inventiveness, creativity. You have to have that constraint. So whether you're making your path through life, going after knowledge, or whether you're building a piece of art, or whether you're doing a scientific experiment, you're going after truth. And there's only one way to get to truth, basically, and that is step by step. And with each step, you're sort of measuring up against reality. Is this step in the right direction or the wrong direction? And as you measure up against reality, and I would say Peterson talks about this, that there's a sense of meaning when you actually get closer to reality, when you get close to the edge where you can touch reality, that sense of meaning comes in. And with art, I mean, sometime when we have more time, maybe I'll go through the whole thing with you about how a painting works and how you get that sense of meaning, and how a piece of art gets constructed. But I think life and science are exactly the same process of going after truth. But the only way you can get there is with this constant bumping up against reality and finding out whether you're not in the right place, right? Does that make sense to you?
That makes a lot of sense. And so as you take each step is really the part of the creative process, right? Just like every step, every decision in life is akin to the every decision in the piece of, in the work of art.
Yes.
Maybe I don't know the end goal of my life, but sometimes I can know what the end purpose, or at least the end vision of what I want the art to accomplish, how I want others to feel from the art. And I think it was Tozer that said that everything that exists came out of and is dependent upon the continuing creative impulse. There's this continuing creative impulse in us, but also in the creation that continues pressing and urging. And that's each step, in my opinion, our steps are being pulsed out by the creator himself to propel us forward. And that is also one of the things that lends me to believe that there is such thing as the process of free will, that we're being pulsed out of the creation himself, but yet we are a creative agent ourselves. Like there's some optionalities there. I mean, I look at the artwork that you've done with the cellists and the dancers and the sorts of rhythmic prose that others write. I see this beauty there. And I can't help but thinking that we're a creator's creator, that it goes to that second level. And so whenever I have an entrepreneurial impulse, because I'm not an artist, I think about how could that make others feel about how I feel. Like I want to be able to display my emotions and my feelings as a painter. Remember, I'm coming from a jazz trumpet background. I have a good deal of music theory way, way, way in the back. And so I'm thinking about that harmonically, melodically. What would happen if I changed the time signature to this? The signature, maybe the cadence of meetings, or the cadence of reports, what would happen there? And there's this duality of the things that I could change about every step. And it's all being driven forth by the creative impulse that it's sort of a double pulse. It's Christ pulsing, then me pulsing off of his pulse, as the creator's created. And that brings me to this whole idea of color and context in what we're dealing with. You go back and you read, you know, I think it was around 1882 when Van Gogh, he just went nuts. He went nuts and this is about the time he marries the prostitute. And he's told by his priest, hey, you can't come back. We don't want you here. And he eventually ends up in a insane asylum. And he writes to his brother Theo. He was not a successful artist around this time. You probably know the story a lot better than I do. He writes to his brother Theo, which is really his only client. And he says that the color expresses something in itself. It you just can't do anything without it. Like, you've got to have the color. You have to make use of it. And he says this, he says that what looks beautiful, what looks really beautiful, is also right. He connects the rightness and the beauty together within the context of art. But then you've got the almost identical saying. I don't know if you've heard this, people reference this article, this Richard Wigner article about the
The unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics.
yes. Bertrand Russell has an opening quote in that article up there, and he says almost the identical thing about the convergence of beauty and rightness of mathematics, and how that's very much like poetry. So you've got the atheist Bertrand Russell writing that in one of the preeminent apologetical arguments, in my opinion, in this mathematical journal. And then you also have a century before, you have Van Gogh writing this about art. Almost the same thing, math and art. And it's amazing that we can see this creativity burgeon out of all of our various domains. And it comes from the technical sciences, but it also comes from the arts, from the beauty there. And I think it's not because it's built into the domains itself, but it's built into us. Like, we're the beings that seek beauty, that seek texture. We seek the canvas, and we just want something to be able to live out, to spill on the canvas, so that others may see, hey, this is a beautiful soul here. Or I see. We want others to feel what we feel, and to know what we know, and to see what we see. And the gift of being an artist, I would imagine, would be that you can actually effectuate that, and at least have that hope where some of us cannot.
Well, I'm of the opinion that anything actually coming out of the creative impulse that's coming from the creator, whether it's cooking a great meal or building a great company or making a painting, any of those things is expressing the creativity that God gave us. And so there's going to be beauty there. But I wanted to say, when you were talking about science, absolutely, scientists are trying to find the truth. They're seeking the truth. But they also have believed, especially since I think it was Popper that said that everything has to be falsifiable in science. If it's not falsifiable, it's not anything that you can actually call science. Which, of course, if you take that as truth, then that's going to write off anything that isn't material reality that can be measured or quantified. But nevertheless, the scientists are seeking truth, and they recognize that they can't ever get to the ultimate truth. They can just find a truth. They can find a truth in the landscape of truth, just the way mathematicians kind of look at the landscape of mathematical possibility. And they'll go after some little aspect of it, and then they'll work on that until they get it crystallized into the world. And this is where they find this beauty in mathematics. So the scientists are going after truth. An artist is also going after truth. And there's so much here. Anyway, there's this physicist named Nima Arkani Hamed who did a wonderful lecture called The Morality of Fundamental Physics, where he talks about there's two big aspects of it. One aspect is what does truth look like when you find it? So let's say Newton's law of gravity, laws of gravitation, all of Newton's laws create this beautiful crystal truth that will forever be true, even though Einstein came along and saw a new perspective on the truth. That doesn't change Newton's laws from being true and functional and useful. Einstein comes along, and the way Hamed talks about it, it's a higher mountain because from the top of relativity, you can see more of the landscape. So you have these two mountains, Newton and Einstein. When whatever comes after Einstein will may be a higher mountain, but it won't be any more true or less true than either of those. So there's this aspect to truth, and in order to get to it, a scientist has to be absolutely moral in their behavior, because if they deviate from moral behavior by cheating or by lying or by being strictly driven by their own biases or by riches, it's going to skew their data and it's going to make it less true. So you have this situation going on in science. In art, you have something very similar, really, in that the artist has to be faithful to the vision so that every time a stroke goes down, you have the image in your head, and then that stroke, is it getting you closer or further from the vision? Okay. Now, in an artist's life, it can't just be one painting that represents their whole vision. You paint one painting and you don't get to the vision. You never get to the vision because your vision is always way out ahead of your skill. So you have to you look at the end, painting at the end and you say, now, what skills do I need to get the vision that's in my head out on the paper? And then you do another painting, and then you do another painting. You keep building skills and doing more paintings. Then you can take all these paintings and lay them out on the ground, and you can look at all of them. What are the strengths and weaknesses in this group as a whole that I can learn from so that I can move up another level from this level? So I just think this structure of reality is there in the art realm, in the science realm, and in actually living our lives. Whenever we reflect on our lives, we go back and we look at events in our life. Where did I go wrong? You know, what could I have done better? And then we learn and then we move on. And you talk about the pulse pushing you. I also think there's something drawing us, and that it's that golden thread or that the hope that's out in front of us that's drawing us forward. So
Yes.
we're being pushed and we're being drawn, and that's what gives us an opportunity to have access to getting closer to the truth. We can never get there, but that's the beauty of it, because if we could get there, we would stop building skills, we would stop growing, we would stop relating with other people that would help us to get closer to this vision.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And I want to go back to where you started with Einstein and Newton, obviously Galileo prior to that as well. You've got this sort of perfection where you've got the two hills that you called it. You've got the Newtonian hill, which is accurate to about one part in 10 million. Then you've got the Einsteinian special theory of relativity, I think 1906, somewhere around there, where he came out with that. And that was accurate to one in 10 million, 10 millionths, I think, something like that. But then when we came out with the general theory, a little bit later on, the specificity remained, it did get better, but then the applicability broadened. It became rich, enriching, so that it also covered things like gravitational time distortions. It covered Big Bang cosmology. It covered microquasars, where the special theory and obviously Newtonian and Galilean physics did not encompass. And so, how did he get there? How did he get there? Well, he had these imaginative mind experiments that he did, these thought experiments. And you look and see, when was the experiment actually done? Well, the experiment was done by a group of colleagues who observed him when the weather was right, years and years later after the theories were published. And you hear about these multiple year delays from that. And that tells you a lot about the nature of time whenever a genius inhabits the time, so that you have these two bumps that happen in science, where you've got that, what, 1906, and whatever the general theory was, 1914, something like that, that happened because you had one genius. But then nothing, essentially, for 100 years. Maybe with your guess that you told me about, maybe you've got something different there. But you basically have nothing changing, because a genius mind is so rare. And whenever the genius mind is met with the imaginative brilliance of someone like an Einstein, well, it naturally has to change the world. It's this balance that you talked about earlier, about the right brain and left brain. It's the technicality, but also the attraction to beauty and the simplicity and the pursuit that drives them whenever they're working in tandem. And I think there's a lot to that whenever we get this idea of in our art and our life of trying to get greater scope plus precision, we tend to create in businesses, we create more processes, we hire more people, we try to make it happen on our own. But really what needs to happen is it needs to be a sacrificial move. And I'm gonna go back to Lewis on this. Nothing that you've not given away will ever really be yours. It's you've got to give up in order to get. And you see that happen where Einstein, he still uses the paper, but he leans heavily on the imagination to get him to take really to take humanity to the next level. So then you have Muskian interplanetary species all of a sudden becomes possible. You have the possibility that we could eventually one day go to Mars for lunch and then the next afternoon be 100 million light years away for dinner. You have all these sorts of things that are possibilities because you had one great mind that had a great imagination. Imagine what would happen if we had 100 more of those great minds, 100 more of those geniuses, where humanity would be. It would be almost too much. You almost have the realization of the snake in the garden, you shall be like gods. We'd have too much knowledge, right? The tree of knowledge was the curse. And so that's why the pursuit of knowledge concerns me a little bit. I'm not anti-knowledge, but the weightiness of knowledge weighs us down so much that we can never escape the gravity of our sin, the gravity of depravity, the gravity of the original tree. And I need to escape that gravity in order to live.
Yeah, I mean, you brought up so many things there. So in terms of why there's been no, they say there's been no significant science really done for the last 70 years, for sure. But I think that that's a lot of that is a function of follow the money. When all this money started dumping into grants and everything, then that pushes the scientists to write grant applications that will get them money, and then that grant application has to satisfy the people who are giving the grants rather than satisfying whatever is in the scientist's mind that might have been a path that he would have followed otherwise. And likewise, the scientific community, as far as I understand it, is really into you just one step after another, you do a small experiment and then you see how that works out, and then you do another small experiment and you see how that works out. And there's not a lot of time given to people to think and to ponder and to do the kinds of, as I remember, I think Einstein was able to do all that thinking because he was working in a job as a clerk and it didn't require a lot of mind share. But if you were locked up in a science lab where you're having to do a lot of research on things that are irrelevant to what's actually in your brain, then you're not going to have the mind share that you need to have these creative breakthroughs. And I also think there's something else missing because I know for me, I never felt like I was a creative person at all. But when I was 50, I decided to take a watercolor class to learn how to paint. And I was so terrible at the beginning that I was going to quit because I didn't like the feeling of being a fool. But I got the long view and I decided to, stick with it.
Yeah.
And over time, I ran into this class that I could take on creativity. And the whole point of the creativity class was we're going to put down really strong constraints around you. And then that is going to jumpstart creativity. And the constraint was, you're not going to learn how to paint in this class. You're just going to learn how to think. And so the class was looking at the elements and principles of design and how they function. And then every week you bring in two large paintings so that everybody can see what you did during the previous week. And we're going to analyze it according to the elements and principles of design. But every painting has to be of the same subject. So for 20 paintings, you can only paint the same thing over and over and over and over again. So, if you're a typical watercolorist or painter of any kind, you have in mind, I'm going to do a a pot of flowers and maybe a cup of tea or something on the side. Now, the second time I do it, maybe I'll change the colors a little bit. The third time I do it, maybe I'll make it smaller or bigger. But pretty soon you run out of things to do that are just actually representing that pot of flowers.
Yes.
And then you have to say, well, but what if? You know, what if instead of looking at this pot of flowers, what if I look at the relationship between the light and the pot of flowers? Or what if I look at the relationship between the edges and the rest of the painting? Or what if I look at the relationship between the texture and the color? So you start thinking in terms of relationships instead of substance. And the minute you start thinking about relationships instead of substance, instead of things, this light bulb goes off. And honestly, the first time I took that course, by the time I got done with my 20 paintings of a pianist, I could have done another 150. I couldn't shut the spigot off. I had never had any interest in creativity except just try to make the photograph reappear on my piece of paper. But then that became completely irrelevant to me because now I could see all these relationships between line and size and shape and color and unity and harmony and contrast and repetition and variation and gradation and balance all working their way through this image and bringing the image into being. And I could see that in God's creation all around me. And I could see it in every scientific paper I read. And, you know, in every musical composition that I heard, and it's just like the whole world opened up to me.
Yes,
Right?
yes, yes. No, I love that. I love that. And that's what music is. Music is all about the
Exactly.
relationships with the tonalities and the
Yep.
relationships within between the rhythms. I think of someone like the founder of the father of bebop, Dizzy Gillespie. He wrote a song called Salt Peanuts. And Salt Peanuts is it's an octave, bop, 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 salt peanuts. And it's a perfect octave. And if you're not a musician, all you need to know about the perfect octave is that if the lower and the higher are either double the frequency or half the frequency from each other. But the human ear hears them as this exact same note when you hear it. But they're also the furthest apart any two notes can get on a scale. So they're the furthest apart, but they sound the same, but they're also double or half the waves. And there is something really unique where you begin to take the mathematics of art, I would imagine, the chemical balancing of the painting, of the paints, the width and of the brushes, the instrumentation, the vulgarity that you can impose by having multiple time signatures over multiple key signatures in the same measure is just astronomical. But that is where the beauty arises from. You never have beauty without textured, kind of, it's a sandpaper. It's a sandpaper that has to come before the release. It's that constraint that you talked about. You have to have some sort of constraint in order to have the freedom to be able to manipulate, to effectuate your will within the canvas, within the artwork. Like, I've got to have a key signature in order to improvise over. I've got to have a time signature of some sort. You can't say, "Hey, Rick, improvise in any key." It won't sound good. It won't, I won't, and I won't enjoy it. I have too many options. I have way too many options.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
so you see this, you see this happening time and time again. I think about the album Take Five by Dave Brubeck. Columbia Records was producing that album. I think he was on a 3 or 4 album production schedule, and some of the guys in his band were playing around with different time signatures. And 4/4 is kind of the standard time. Most classical music's in 4/4, 3/4, or 6/8, some kind of derivative. 3/4 and 6/8 are basically the same for most people. And so the improvisers, they could always improvise in 4/4, kind of standard 1/2/3/4, 1/2/3/4 time, or they can improvise in 3/4 time, 1/2/3, 1/2/3 time signatures. But Dave Brubeck came in and said, "I'm going to create a piece that is in 5/4, 1/2/3/4/5, 1/2/3/4/5." So it's a 2 plus a 3. And these saxophoners just had the most difficult time ever. They could not figure out how to improvise on this because they were seeing it as a 5/4. but they were thinking of it as an adult. A child would look at it and say, well, this is just a 2 plus a 3. That's all a 5 is a 2 plus a 3. And so for years, it baffled professional musicians because they thought they saw this big five, this big hairy five in the key signature and the time signature, and they didn't realize the 5 is just a 2 plus a 3. And what ended up happening was Columbia Records kept shooting him down because no one could improvise over it. Only he could. And if the general public's not worried about this, but what Dave Brubeck realized was that if he was going to take jazz to the next level, he had to detach from the standard time signatures that were enslaving jazz itself, right? Miles Davis had already unleashed the modality of the music into new keys. He would take it into the Deshi, into the Indian, the Vedic, and even the Islamic keys with these half tonalities. But then it was Dave Brubeck that needed to unleash the world of jazz from time itself. And that's essentially what he did. And after three rejections, Columbia actually produced the record, and it actually ended up being, for a time, the number one jazz single of all time. Because what the people wanted was something just totally unique, because they saw the creativity. And it wasn't that he did it because it was difficult. He did it because it was right. Like, you've got to unshackle yourself from all the constraints, from the colors, from the key signatures, from the time signatures, from the pencils. You've got to unshackle yourself if you're truly to be creative. But then you also have to have the constraints bearing down on you in other new ways. And it's that bearing of the constraints plus the freeing of the unshackling that creates the nuance that gives rise to the new sciences, the new arts, and to new forms of beauty that all mimic and reflect, in a Girardian way, our creator.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what happened. The problem that came out of abstract expressionism is that they wanted to give up all the constraints, but they never found a new constraint. And so everything just evaporates out into the void. And this is a bit of what's happening with science, I think, because if you take as your premise that the only way to find truth is to divide things down to the very smallest part and then try to figure out how the whole world was constructed out of those smallest parts, and but you're not willing to think about the whole that those parts came out of, and you've given up all your constraints, and you're now in a world where there's no edges, there's no boundaries, and there's no meaning. Because a cell is constructed out of a lot of intricate machinery and many trillions of parts inside that cell, but it has to have the boundary of the cell in order for it to be a living thing. If you took the boundary off, all that stuff would just evaporate out.
Yes.
Like gas molecules, when you take them out of the box, they just move out into the void,
Yes. And you notice what's happening in our conversation. Most of the conversations about these sorts of topics are stay up here in the ethereal. I think I mentioned to Paul this idea of the ladder of abstraction, that everything kind of stays up here. If you listen to Verveke, listen to Pajot sometimes, it kind of stays up on a kind of 7, 8, 9 level on this ladder, but it never kind of comes down here to find its concrete corollary. And your conversation about cells, about artwork, about brushstrokes, about pianos, I mean, that's really what we need to sort of ground our senses and like, this is how it relates to us. It's not just this abstract theory over here about beauty and time and truth and creativity. It has a real concrete manifestation. Now, the concrete material is shadowed forth from the meaning above, platonically, in my opinion, but it's shadowed down from the higher, but you still have both. You still have the esoteric, sort of the ethereal up here, the big grand ideas, but it still has to become relatable to us in our natural lives and our everyday lives in our natural world. And I really appreciate the way that you've posed this, especially here in some of your other interviews, Karen, that it's just it these are real things that we need to consider. They really impact us in our lives.
Well, and that I think, I hear people talk all the time about how there is the transcendence of God and the immanence of God. And I mean, it has to be that way. The scripture tells us that we are in Christ, but he is also in us. So I mean, there's this picture of the inside and the outside, but then it scales all the way up until you get to the transcendent. But that embodiment, that the way that we can sense when we are in touch with both the immanence and the transcendence has to come from our bodies. That's what we have. And that comes with this sense of meaning. Now, Peterson always talks about how when you're listening to a great symphony or something like that, and there's all the different themes going on, and there's all the different layers and levels, and then there's a certain point in the symphony when everything just starts to stack up. And when that happens, in that moment, you get a visceral sense of something. Something has happened. Or you see a sunset that's just like, it is the moment, that moment. So DC Schindler talks about, when he talks about love, he says that he thinks love is closer to beauty, that beauty and love are actually kind of inhabiting the same space. But what it's as though the beauty is taken up into you when you see the beauty, or when you experience the beauty, or you experience the meaning. But at the same time, we are taken up into the beauty. So the beauty is taken up into us, and we are taken up into the beauty. And I think that when that happens, there is a, I'm going to use the wrong word here, but like a deformation. There's an impression, there's an engraving that takes place when I am taken up into something. The something I am taken up into is going to be impacted by the shape of me. And when something is taken up into me, that something is going to be impacted by the shape of me, but I'm also going to be impacted by the shape of it. It's like, you know, we are engraved on the palms of his hands. That is my identity that is engraved onto the palms of his hands, because he has this close encounter with us. So in the same way, and I think it was Carl Friston, and maybe he got this from somebody else, that says that an organism basically needs to have an interior map of the cosmos with which they interact. So for an organism to move forward in the world, they have to know something of the world they're moving forward into. And to me, what that says is that's a given. Then that sense of what the cosmos is already a given for the entity. I don't think that's something, I don't think there's any way to build life out of some non-living thing into some rudimentary cell. And then from that, get cells that are building up into something larger, because each one, in order to be alive, needs to have a map of what it's interacting with. I just don't think it works, you know? So I think in this picture of embodiment and the experience that we have of touching up, of contact with reality, where we find meaning, it's that sense of meaning that tells us when we've gotten close. You know, and it's not just utilitarianism. It's not just what works. A lot of cognitive scientists will talk about that the foundations of consciousness are in the brainstem itself, because the brainstem, even before we had brain hemispheres, the brainstem could tell whether the organism was hot or cold, and help get it back into homeostasis, whether it's hot or cold, or whether it's close or far. This the brainstem had this function of, which, if you think about it, is a function of value, valuing. You have to be valuing in order to tell where you are on that scale, right? So, but if that's all it was, then all that we would be moving towards is the comfort level, or what keeps us alive. But that's not how human beings are. We're not driven by comfort. If we were, there would never be sacrifice. We're driven by meaning, not by comfort.
That's interesting. That's interesting. So I think that the fulfilled person has to have someone to love, but also has to have an enemy to fight. I really think that we've got to have both. And if we're to find that, and that is, in my opinion, probably the best type of pursuit, that sort of the dual pursuit, that a great enemy is worth more than a best friend sometimes. That we have that will solve a number of our issues concerning what we think we're made of, or what is embodied in us, how we know, what sort of this code is that is informing us how to proceed about this. But obviously the we have the 3 billion character DNA that's embedded, and we are communication itself. Like we are technically communication. Like we are the Rosh, we are the breath, we are the logos, we are the word manifested that then go back and repropagate again, because that's what we do. Everything that has breath also propagates as a species, and so we've got those two things going. We have sort of the pursuit that we, in my opinion, we feel most fulfilled when we have someone to love and also someone to fight, worthy in they have to be a worthy enemy too, but then on the technical level, we feel this sort of communication, this breath that has made us, but it also sort of encodes us what we should be doing. Sort of the thing that you were talking about again a second ago, Karen, that you have these two things that are in balance, and whenever the two are overlapping, what we have is this side over here, which is the loving and the enemy fighting side of us, that these two come together. And the purpose becomes not the acting, but the purpose becomes the actual becoming. Like my ultimate purpose is not to do something, it's to become someone. And that someone just happens to be the reflection of the creator, the original inhabitant of the original garden, in some way, shape, or form. And I see a lot of that. Now you made one comment about Peterson a second ago. I want to get back to this idea of us looking on. I think there was a phrase in there about that a second ago, Karen. Peterson uses this. He goes back to the idea of the snake in the cross, where Moses lifts up the staff, and us looking on that is us being healed. But he never gets to the other side of the story. The other side of the story is that yeah, that helps us see the solution. And this is an Epictetus and a Heraclitian type of belief here as well, that what we see we become. But the other half is the stronger half, and that's when the maker of the universe sees us. That's when we're made to be the type of people we were meant to be. That's when we're transformed. It's not us seeing, it's him looking back, and it's the gaze of the infinite divine back on us through the person of Christ that heals us, that makes us whole, that adopts us, and it gives us this inheritance that is pervasive throughout the Pauline writings. It's the gaze of Christ that we seek, and the gaze of Christ is this well done, good and faithful son, daughter. It's the fame that he bestows on us, because we're just innocent children wanting to please our father. I mean, it's that sort of thing. And so I think when we only see that, if we think it's just us looking on the right thing, that is a very action-oriented type of theology. It's you also have the idea that's set forth in Ephesians chapter 1 and even Ephesians chapter 2. Hey, we're not worthy. We're dirty rebels. We were walking in our dead and our depraved death and our depravity, but Christ came, and God loved us, and he adopted us as sons and daughters, and he leads us into this new life because he looks on us, and he loved us. And it's that looking on by God that's infinitely more important than me looking on some sort of symbol or even on the cross, because I'm weak in my looking, in my perception of what the cross is. Like I can't comprehend it. The finite cannot grasp the infinite. But the infinite, when he looks on me as a finite, he gives me a spark of the divine, the spark of the eternality, the spark of the infinite within me, and that makes me live really and truly.
Yeah, I love that the loving gaze is reciprocal.
Yeah, yeah.
When you
And
were
you, and
talking
you
about the serpent on the stick, It made me think about a painting that is in the Accademia Museum in Venice, and it's called the something of the serpents. I can't remember it, but it's an image of that passage in the Old Testament. And the painting is probably 40 feet wide and 15 feet
Wow.
high. And you can't get a picture. I mean, there's no way to, they don't even put a picture online because it's impossible to show it. Just to show it in the panorama, it's, this high and it's this wide. But it's the whole panorama of all the people struggling with the snakes on the ground. But you can tell clearly when you look at the painting. I don't know how he did it. I have no idea how he did it. I think the author, the artist was Tiepolo. But each person fighting with a snake, you can tell they're fighting with their own sin. You can see it clearly that the battle with is it's that battle with their own sin within, and every one of them is unique, and every battle that's going on is a unique battle. And then there is the pole with the serpent on it. And to me, the picture that I got when I was looking at that was, if I focus on my sin, I'm always going to lose. But if I focus on Christ, that is the path forward. Because it says in Hebrews, fix your eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of your faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Well, the joy set before him is his loving gaze on me. So if I'm contemplating the fact that he sees me and my being as part of the joy for which he was willing to endure that, that is transformative. That is the transformation of the loving gaze. But it also gets my gaze off of my own sin and inadequacies and gets my gaze onto him, because that's where the hope resides, and that's where that will draw me forward up into him rather than further down into my own failure.
Yes. And we have to figure out what are we looking at when we're looking at the snake, right? I think Peterson would say that you're looking at that which is your worst enemy, the thing you most need to face, like the kind of that darkest place of the forest where the last thing you want to do is the next thing you need to do, right? It's the most scariest thing you can imagine. It's the solution to your venom. It's that sort of thing. But I think we've got to ask also, kind of go back to the whole idea of sacrifice and free will, that is the greatest thing we can do is to face our greatest fear, or is the greatest thing we can do to lay down something that's incomprehensibly valuable to us, right? Anything that's worth keeping is worth sacrificing. Nothing that was not keeping worth keeping is worthy of any offering. We have to give something of value. That's the sign, right? We're in a world that's lubricated by blood. This is a blood-entrenched reality that we live. And so we have to be sacrificially minded, and sacrifice, it gets talked about sort of up here in the ethereal, but it doesn't get talked about down here in the concrete enough in this corner sort of area in the Petersonian area of the internet. And so we have to figure out what did the people that are wiser that went before us, what did they think needed to be sacrificed in the Christian tradition. And I think you go back to just down the road from Venice, there in Florence, you go to Dante. He said that, in a religious vow, this is one of the translations, obviously. I don't speak Florentine Italian, but in the religious vow, it's the monastic vow, and that's the best type of vow to take. But in the monastic vow, what happens is the will gives itself up, just like the victim's off life is actually laid down on the altar. And here's the thing. the will cannot will itself back to itself. The will cannot will itself back to itself. Well, why is that important? Why is it like, why out of all the things, why wouldn't you say the soul? Why wouldn't you say your personality? Why wouldn't you say your wealth? Why wouldn't you say your career, your aspirations, your pursuit, your destiny, your meaning? Why would you say, why would Dante say you lay your will down? It's because it's the only thing that can't will itself back to itself. It's the only irreversible gift. Because the thing that we need to do, this is a strategy item here, that in order to win, you must first not lose. Like that's rule number one in great investing is you don't lose your money. Don't lose money. Dante knew that. And he says this because the man or the woman that goes and gives the sacrifice to the gods, that gives a sacrifice to Christ, they'll take it back up off the offer, off the altar every single time. They always take it back. And an offering that is given, a sacrifice that is put on the altar and is ungiven, it's taken back, becomes a curse. And that's how we lose. That's how we lose. Just like the investor, if you lose your money, if you lose all your money, you have no investment left. You cannot be an investor. In order to be a Christian, you've got to give up something you cannot physically take back. And that's your will. You have to surrender your free will on the altar of God, because that's the only thing that you can ever take back. And if you do that, you somehow, in the words of Ella Wilcox, you take part in the divine there, because the will is nothing but the daughter of the soul, and they're both eternal. The soul's eternal, and the will's eternal, because the will is rooted in an eternal seed there, and your will must give up itself. You will to be what you will be. Like the willing to be something is the actual will. That's what it is. It's not technically a thing. It's your desire, it's your actions, it's all of you. And it's the child, it's the action portion of the soul. And that's what has to be laid down. And I think that's what Dante was talking about. Like, I'm not smart enough, and I doubt there's another Dantean type of mind alive right now that I can go ask about this. This is why we've got to go back to ask our forefathers about, hey, what should we be doing here? And this is what Dante says, and I believe Dante.
Well, okay, so that's a beautiful picture. Before we get there, I want to go back and say something about what you said about the serpent and what was the serpent on the cross, and you gave the whole Petersonian thing. And I think the thing he's missing there is that Jesus himself, I mean, it says in the scripture that he became sin for me. He became my sin for me so that my sin would be nailed to the cross. So the people who were fighting with the serpents on the ground are fighting with their own sin, but Jesus became that sin on the cross. And so in a sense, that sinful will that is in me was nailed to the cross. And I'm not a theologian, so I'm not going to go down that road, but I want to go back to this picture that you built of the will being the daughter of the soul, and that the will cannot will itself back to itself. So what the sacrifice that we need to make is to put our own will on the altar. When you do that, and I don't know of anybody who... There probably are some who have done that consistently throughout their whole lives, but I've only been able to achieve it ever for, you know, brief moments of time. But what comes out of that for me when I really can put my will down is that then, because I have no more will in me, action arises out of the will. So any action that arises out of me after that moment is action that has been willed by Christ himself. And that is when the act of love can be expressed. When I can give up, if there's somebody, there was somebody recently that I needed to interact with that has in a lot of ways been a thorn in my side for 20 years. And yet God gave me an opportunity in that person's life, and everything in me wanted to run the other direction. So in order to move into that and to love that person and to give and to help in that situation, I had to let go of all my own will. I had to, because there was nothing in me that could have offered love in that situation. But the beautiful thing is that the minute you do that, the minute you surrender that will, then Christ moves in, and then it becomes natural to move in and love that person. And so, I mean, it has to be true what you're saying. It has to be true because I've experienced it. And it's the only time it's ever natural for me to love somebody. All the other times I might think I'm actually loving them and acting in love, but really it's just filthy rags. It's all my own stuff, you know.
Yeah. It's like the reality shows about 10 years ago, they stopped saying I love you. They started saying I think I've fallen for you, right?
Oh,
It's kind of the
I
fake
don't
love, the
watch that
non-committal
stuff, so
love.
I have no idea.
No one says I love you anymore. I think I've fallen for you, I think is what the phrase is these days with the kids. But there's this thing that the sacrificed will, right? Paul says that present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing. So you have these two things going on there, but remember what Ephesians 2, 1 through 3 says, that we were dead, but we were also walking and moving around in our transgressions and our sins, that we were basically walking zombies. He's calling us to be kind of the opposite of that, the person who's fully committed, fully died, but also walking around in this, in a sort of this new living life instead of this dying death. But what happens? What happens is the It's not the opposite, but it's similar to a hierarchy. And I hate even using the word hierarchy in this part of the internet, because it has so much connotations. Everyone talks about it. But it's something like this. It's like the vow that this monastic vow that I mentioned earlier is made by a will that's been fully submitted, that's been fully given over to Christ, and that from that vow, that monastic vow, cascades. Sort of the same shape as a hierarchy, but it cascades down to every single part of our life. Now that cascadence is what that is something that has ripples, that has variations in it. Like a great painting will also have dark and light, will have a little bit of ugliness, but also have a little bit of beauty, like in Rembrandt. You'll see these variations off and on, and this is what our lives are like. That's why we can't act perfectly. Paul says, I know what I want to do, but there's my evil sinning body at every turn doing the opposite of what I want to do. But I know I need to do this. It's that sort of thing. It's this fight that happens, but it's happening not at the will level, not at the vow level, but in the cascadence down into our daily lives. And the goal of the man or the woman that wants to pursue Christ is that all of that be sanctified. All that be sanctified. Now, I'm a Baptist, and so when I read Romans chapter 8 verses 28 through 30, and that whole section, I'm thinking the final sanctification comes after we're dead and we're glorified. But I grew up in the Wesleyan tradition, which says that hey, I can have some sanctification right now. In fact, it's possible for you to string out a minute, and then an hour, and 2 hours, and 3 hours, maybe a couple of days, where I live in a mode of holiness, of sanctification. And I can't do that on my own, but it's the Holy Spirit that comes and just invades, because I've given up my will to him, and he's living through me, and my free will's been absconded with, and it's been replaced by the Holy Spirit. Maybe that's possible. I don't think that I can, we want to live perfect lives, Karen, but I don't think we're going to do that now. But I think the best we can hope for is to live every moment that we can in holiness. If we lapse, next moment, hey, I'm going to live a holy moment. I'm going to live a holy moment. I'm a holy, holy moment. And if we can get a string of those together, it's not what I say I want to be, it's what I actually am that matters. And I think what God is judging us on is not what we actually do, but what we aspire to do based off versus what we could have been. Like, I could have been the most evil, satanic devil incarnate. If I was allowed to live 1,000 years at my natural proclivities, but thank God I'm not, because he's given these artful constraints. I have a certain number of years and a certain amount of bandwidth and a certain amount of relationships that I can handle, just like an art piece. I can concentrate on that, and out of those constraints, I can create something beautiful there. But it's not me creating the beauty; it's him pulsing through me that then creates the beauty that guides my hands and guides my eyes and my mind and my imagination, that all converge on the canvas of my life and my only hope is that others would see that and say, wow, that's beautiful. If he can do it, then I can want to do that. If and just the mere wanting to do it is enough from my perspective.
Yeah, I've often thought about how the constraints on our lives are such a gift. You know, the fact that we have to work in order to earn enough money to live is a beautiful gift, because if we had all that time, you know,
Yes.
it's the devil's workshop if we just have a lot of time on our hands, right? So every constraint that we have is actually a gift that's providing more opportunity. And you said earlier, you said we all need to love someone and we all need an enemy to fight against because of the coincidence of opposites, right? But when you said that earlier, the immediate thought that came into my mind was, I am my own worst enemy. So I have an automatic enemy to fight against every minute of every day. So God has already given me everything I need for holiness. He's given me, he's granted me love because we love because he first loved us.
Yes.
And then he's, you know, given me the path, the opportunity to love others. So I have someone to love. He'll always put someone in my path to love, but he's also given me my own worst enemy because I can always be fighting against the snakes in my own heart. And I know there are a lot of different theological perspectives on how we overcome. To me, you know, Peterson has some little nuggets that I think are so helpful just in creating a frame. And one of his little nuggets is, it's not your position that's important, it's your trajectory. So if you are always looking up towards the highest good of which you can conceive, which for me is God, and then that means he's going to draw me on that trajectory. It's an upward trajectory. So you know, every day his mercies are new every morning, and there's always that upward trajectory for hope. So,
Yes. And as you look higher and higher, the stakes increase. The higher the promise, the more costly the sacrifice, and the more devout the vow has to be. And the higher we look, the lower we have to be, right? You can only see the grandeur of the mountains if you're in the valley. And I hate to use that overused analogy there, that figurative language there, but it's true. It's true. Like in the depths of the depravity of our lives, if we can just have something to look up to, I mean, that's living. That's life itself. Knowing that you're a sinner, but you can look up at the grandeur that God's created, and you have, you know, and you see him shining back on you. Hey, dirty rubble, I love you. I love you. And that is the greatest hope of humanity, to hear those words, I love you, from the highest possible point all the way down to the depths. And that's really, from my opinion, that is what I hope for, is that how can we take the highest possible promise and the highest the greatest possible sacrifice, and then out of that, which both those two things have come from God, how can I give him back the most devout possible vow, which is the gift of everything that I have, and let that cascade throughout my very being? There's got to be a way that I can keep that in the forefront in my every word and my every deed. And I, even just speaking with you, Karen, I'm battling, like, if I say this, I'll sound smarter. You know, I mean, because I'm not an educated person at all.
Oh, we have that in common.
Well, but it's like that. It's my own pride still kind of trying to ram at me here, and when I'm trying to
Absolutely.
talk about God,
It's an
it's just the way.
every minute battle. It's an every minute battle, you know. How do I have something I have to say right now, or can I just sit back and learn and listen and let God create the space in between? Because when you started talking about the mountain, immediately, and I'm going to say this anyway, I don't know how it makes me sound, but before I was a Christian, I was invited to a little country church where they had some musicians playing some gospel music. But I'm like, whatever, who are these people? I could care less. And they sang a song, and the song made me so mad. Well, really, the testimony before the song made me mad. And I walked out of there just thinking, I don't need those people. She was talking about this song as She needed God to help her up the mountain. And I walked out of there thinking, I don't need anybody to help me up the mountain. I can make it up the mountain on my own. But of course, about 2 months later, I became a Christian. So, but the song has these great words. When I'm low in spirit, I cry, Lord, lift me up. I want to go higher with thee. But the Lord knows I can't live on a mountain. So he picked out a valley for me.
That's lovely. That is so lovely.
Yeah, so the valley has a lot of pictures, right? The valley is the struggle, but the valley is also the place where the green grass is, where the shepherd takes care of the sheep. And the valley is also the place where you can see how big the mountain is. And so.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Yeah, I mean, I've been so encouraged by the various voices sort of in this kind of TLC, this little corner here. And it's been interesting to see the beatific mindset of the different ways of looking at us in proximity to God, right? That what you just said was just one of the loveliest things I've ever heard about how we approach God and the rightful position where we should be. And it always comes back to me that when we crawl up on that altar, we've come a long ways. We have bleeding knees and bleeding hands, and we crawl up on that altar already blood-soaked as beaten people. But that's the only way somehow paradoxically we get healing. Just like the paradox of being low to be able to go high, the paradox of meek inheriting the earth, paradox of a lamb taking away the sins of the earth, descending in order to ascend. The more you fall, the more likely you are to fail, the more likely you are to succeed. All these paradoxes that are just higher forms of natural truths, they seem to converge the higher you think. And it just blows me away that the people in this area of the internet have conceptualized this and articulated in such a just a wide, diverse array of fashion. It's just really, really encouraging to me. So I really appreciate what you just said, Karen. That was very, very lovely.
Well, I think the reason that we can talk that way is that there are so many different perspectives, but people are willing to love each other and to listen, to learn from each other. So every time that happens, you can move up another, you can get another meta level up and get the higher perspective, you know. Years ago, I heard a message about, I think it's in Ezekiel, maybe chapter 46. I might have the wrong book, where the water begins to come out from under the altar and then begins to move out. And at first it's ankle deep, and then it's knee deep, and then it's thigh deep, and then it's waist deep. And and as the water moves out from the altar and gets deeper and deeper and deeper, if you can picture a world of fences, let's have Chesterton's fences everywhere. When the water gets deep enough, you're up above the fences, so there's no separations anymore. And I think that, that's the picture. I feel like there's some kind of huge move of the spirit going on in the world right now, and you can see it all around you, working through all the different domains. I mean, I see it working in science, I see it working in art, I see it working through all these people talking on the internet. And so we're getting up above the fences, and that's going to make for a lot more community, I think.
Yeah. So what do you, I guess I'm not smart enough to understand the fullness of that analogy. What is the water? What is the water that's rising?
Well, I mean, Jesus said that when you believe in me, out of me, out of you will flow rivers of living water. Now, so here's an interesting thing I ran across just the other day. In the New Testament, it's in the Song of Zechariah in Luke chapter 2, in the Song of Zechariah, I've been reading in the Liturgy of the Hours, and in the translation they're using there, it says he sets us free to worship him without fear. And I thought, free, I don't remember that word. So I went back and I looked it up in the NIV, and I believe there it's either he rescues us or he redeems us. So then I thought, well, I'm going to dig down into that word. I looked at it in the Greek. The Greek word is some kind of, I can't remember exactly. It's like rhumesis or something, RHU something or other. You look back in the history of that Greek word, and it actually has two paths. One is the word that means a flow of water, and the other one means a flow of blood. The other one that means the flow of blood is only shows up in scripture three times, and in every one of those times, it's the story of the woman who had the flow of blood who touched the hem of Jesus' garment. And the flow of water shows up in a lot of places. You know, out of you will flow streams of living water. That's the thing. But to me, what's so amazing is that those two pictures of flow of water and flow of blood are the history of the word that is translated as rescue or redeem. So
Right.
built right into the redemption of Christ is the flow of water and the flow of blood that came from his side when he was crucified. And likewise, the flow of blood from all the sacrifices in the Old Testament and the flow of the living water that shows up in all those pictures in the Old Testament. So, I mean, God's word is so powerful at every level, in every word, every syllable, you know, has layers and layers of meaning.
Yes. And even that story of the woman with the blood, this in kind of the first third of Mark, I believe, you've got Jesus. I think he's coming directly from the region of the Gadarenes, where there was the man. I think he drove the demon out and went into a pigs, and they went down the hillside and they got in the boat and they left. And I think this is like maybe the next scene or two scenes later. And so you've got a Jewish man who's dirty. He's impure. He's been with the dead. He was in tombs. He was around tombs and with a possessed man and pigs, comes in and he's walking through a crowd to go to, I think it's Jairus's house. I think right. This is the great scene where he goes to heal the little girl, and
Who is
he's
12
walking.
years old? Who is 12
Yes,
years old?
that's right. That's right. And
And the
so he's.
woman has been having that flow of blood for 12 years.
That's right. That's right. And she's ceremonially unclean as well, because she's it's happening. And so here's this dirty Jew walking through this crowd. Now, if he was a regular Jew, he would be contaminating everyone. But what we see happen is the woman touches the fringe of his garment and she's made pure. He feels the power flow out of him. And so you have the reverse of what's happened ever since. Instead of him infecting all these people, he purifies all of them. It's not that she was the only one. I would wager a strong guess that everyone in that crowd that touched him was made whole. That everyone that came to him and touched him in faith, that they were healed. That he's actually cleansing people, not because he's ceremonially unclean, but because he's eternally pure. And he walks to, I think it's Jairus's daughter's house, to the house, and he goes into the room. He's in a Greek household. He's a Greek household, but then he uses the Aramaic to the little girl, Talitha Kumi, Talitha Kumi, little girl, rise. He gives her a command to rise from the dead, not only in a language she doesn't understand, but also to ears that cannot hear, and yet she still rises. And you see this full spectrum of the purity and the omniscience and the life-giving overflow of the person of Christ, this beginning logos, come and invade the planet there. And what happens is you see the very thing that happened in Genesis chapter 1 happen in this little girl's warm room, where the command carries with it the power to obey. She had no other choice but to get up and rise, not because she could hear it, not because she understand it, because the source of that command. Same thing that happened in creation. Let there be light. Let the earth bring forth vegetation. Let the land and the water be separated. All these sorts of things from the Creator. The command carries with it the power to obey. And so you have this full spectrum, this breaking down of everything that's ever happened, and really kind of three stories that are all generally one long story there. that's centered around this woman that's got this bleeding problem, and you have the flow. You have this literal flow coming out of the woman. And also you have this flow that sort of cascades forwards and backwards, this purity that happens. And then you also have this flow that where he's speaking Aramaic and he's commanding the girl to come back to life, not only in mirroring what happens in Genesis chapter 1, where he actually creates the world, in John chapter 1, where he's the word that puts on flesh, and in verse 13 of chapter 1, but he also mirrors what happens in the end in Revelation chapter 5, where he opens the scroll and he reads the words and he reads the truth, and all of a sudden from that, all of the bad things that ever happened are made untrue in Tim Keller's words, and it wraps everything up in such a nice neat bow that here he is, here he is, here's he that rides on the horse in the thighs that you talked about in the flow, that one thigh he's got faithful, the other thigh he's got true, and here he is. This is the man.
That's terrific. It makes me want to ask you a question.
Okay.
So let's go back to Genesis chapter one.
Yeah.
When the command, the word is spoken and the creation obeys. But there's one place where it doesn't say that, and that's in chapter one, verse nine. It says, "And then he gathered the waters so that the dry land was revealed." It's not that he spoke the word and the water was separated from the dry land. He gathered the waters so that the dry land was revealed. So I got fascinated with that. And I looked up that word gathered. And that word gathered is translated in that verse as gathered. But every other verse in the Bible, it's translated as hope or wait or endure. So right there in the very beginning, there's some picture about the gathering of the waters that's related to hope. You know how the scripture says that faith is the substance of things hoped for. So somehow in that verse to me, there's a picture right there of the whole trajectory of everything.
Yes. And he said, so I know that I think the NIV, the ESV may differ on that. So, like the ESV, it's got, and God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together in one place. And it was so. And so you're saying, like in the original language, he didn't say that. He actually did the gathering himself.
So that's a good question. Let me just look it up really quick. I can get to it in just a second here.
I had to look it up myself because I didn't know off the top of my head. So I'm cheating with my phone here.
Because I usually look at it in the NAS. So,
But yeah, but he is saying, let the waters under the earth under the heavens be gathered together. And that's different. That sounds different than the next one, like let the earth sprout forth vegetation. It's more sort of indirect,
yes,
is
you're
what it
right.
sounds
It does
like.
say, and God said, let the waters be gathered together under the heavens into one place, and let the dry land appear. But it's still that word is still let be gathered
Yes.
together. That word is still the word for hope or wait.
So do you think it was done with
Here's
gravitation?
another translation. Oh, say Genesis 49:18. For your salvation, I wait, O Lord. Job 3:9. Let the skies wait for the light. The travelers of Sheba waited for them as a hired man who eagerly waits for his wages. When I expected good, then evil came. Expected. Okay. None of those who wait for you will be ashamed. Wait. It's always wait. But in that verse, it's let the waters be gathered together. So there's something about the dry land appearing and a connection with waiting or hoping that, okay, gathering together, that word has also in it this idea of tension or of a cord, like a cord. You would use a cord to gather a sheaf of wheat
Yes.
and tension. I kind of think there's something about quantum physics in that verse, really. That the gathering of the waters has something to do in revealing the dry land. There's some physical picture there that I don't know, but everywhere else it's wait and hope. And since waiting and hoping and enduring are such a big part of our life in Christ, that there's something there about the gathering of the waters.
And so the only right, he's created the heavens and the expanse, and he's created these things so far. And so the next thing where he's separating the he's gathering the water so that there's it forms dry land. The only thing that can have a seed would be the waters and the land. So the waiting would be, in my opinion, would have to do with the things that could be grown, that it would take time for them to arise out of. It would be the same two things. Obviously, you could have birds, but the birds, they would have to be born on land. They have to come out of the land at some point to be able to take flight. And so I think it would have to do with something having to do with a benefit that would be predicated on waiting for something for time to grow out of it. And obviously that those two things, the earth and the waters, are the only two things that would have to give rise to time to be able to have the full fruition, literally and figuratively, of what comes out of the land. That would just be a guess. And it doesn't
Well,
need
it
a
might
guess.
be because the words there that are dry land are the same dry land words that are used when Noah is waiting for the waters to recede and for the dove to find to light on the vine or the tree on the dry land after the land has dried, after the waiting time has happened after the flood. And by the way, did you also know, this is so weird, that the word for atonement in the Old Testament, that is almost always translated atonement, in that passage about Noah building the ark, is the pitch that is used to fill up the cracks in the between the wood, the pitch to make the ark watertight. That's the word for atonement.
I know I did not know
Isn't
that. That
that
is
great?
incredible.
I
That's incredible. Yes, yes,
mean, if
yes.
you just let your curiosity drive you when you're reading, when a word pops out and then you start going after it, it's like, wow, there's so much there. I know I've taken up so much of your time already, but Rick, this has been fantastic. I hope we get to talk again sometime.
Yes, definitely, Karen. It's been a
Okay.
blast. Thank you so much for your invitation. It
Yeah,
was great.
yeah. Thank you. You're a good opposite to bounce ideas off of. So thank you.
Hey, I'm trying to make you look as good as possible. So I that's me. Yeah,
Well,
my wife tells me.
you're so much more well-read than I am with all the philosophy and the history and all that stuff. I
No.
don't have any of that education, so.
Karen, I may be making all this stuff up too. My wife says I'm wrong 99% of the time, which means probably 1% of what I just told you is right. It's your job to find the 1%.
A great day.
All right, be blessed, Karen. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate you.